Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode number 43 of the Apologue Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Head. I don't have any sponsors. I don't have anybody to push here, anything to push. But all I do know is that this is one of the best episodes I ever did on the podcast. It's episode 43. I had to, for content and for people's feelings, I edited some parts out of it. Because in 2015... is not 2019, and that's where we're in at right now. So I want you all to really enjoy this episode for what it was. It was episode number 43. I went down to Al Nolan's house and did it in his place. We're watching a hockey game, having a nice old conversation. Things got a little off the rails with what we were talking about, and that's what I'm trying to address right now. I want to make sure that you listen to this podcast, and although there's still some juicy stuff in there, I added a specific part of it that I think is now unfair to the person involved, and to that person, I apologize. When you get talking, it's tough to imagine that there's actually people listening to this. So anyways, for your listening enjoyment, thank you so much I can't express, like, this is longer than I've been in some bands before, is doing this podcast. So almost 5 years now. And so yeah, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoy it. It's Mr. Al Nolan of Trigger Happy, The Down Belows, and other awesome bands on the Apologue Podcast. I don't even know what episode I'm on now. I know I'm over episode 25, but this is the Apologue Podcast, and I am in Al Nolan's living room watching hockey on a 51-inch 3D television. Al Nolan and I go back 25. There's a lot of smoke over there.
First time I ever saw you was in the parking lot of McDonald's. When you were in Black Faith,
yeah,
with high school Les Berman,
yeah,
and you, and I believe you did a podcast just recently with someone where you talked about your French flag.
That's season. Right.
And I remember seeing that in our local town music store in Pickering, seeing that bass always in there and going, "Oh, that's kind of cool." And then seeing a very skinny teenage Simon Head with what did Les have you guys wear, like? Net kind of
I don't think I ever bought into the outfit.
Well, no, but anyways, you were this tiny kid
playing
this giant bass at Patrick Campbell's house, a guy that we went to high school with at Dunbarton.
That's right. And Moby's band was playing too.
Yes, Charlie Brown's Wang with JP McDonald, Dave Koth, Stuart Chalk. Lee Ryan was their drummer at the time. And it's Lee, I think whatever we're going to get around to talking, must remember that, like, some of the most key important individuals don't even live in the town that we all started our stuff from. Like, you went to a different high school than I did, so there was always different sources or spheres of influence. And,
you were Dunbarton. Yeah.
But if Lee Ryan didn't come into, well, no, if, sorry, you're right. If I didn't go to St. Isaac Jogues Catholic School, I wouldn't have known who James Cavaluzzo was.
Yeah, and, yeah, that's right.
It's funny how everybody's. Everybody kind of connects to each other in some kind of weird way, but I guess we know each other too well to even start on a topic, because we'll just end up switching to one automatically and probably confuse the shit out of everybody that's listening to this.
It's true.
All seven people are moms.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know what?
Marley, get down.
I think we go back a long way, and how we came together is a neat. I don't know.
Oh, it's interesting.
It was totally neat because we were young, and I was eager and stupid and had no idea what music was in the sense of playing in a band.
You had grade 12 piano.
Yeah.
You knew how to play it.
But it's so funny the difference between actually knowing music but living music. Mm. And I didn't really live music until I joined Trigger Happy. And we were called Kingpin back then. And I didn't understand what it was like to self-promote
Well, the first thing you said to me was, I'll do it for $150 a night and a hotel room every night.
You yeah, know what? Whatever. I got that wish finally.
Get out of here.
It took
not
30
from
years, finally.
Not from fucking me.
It took 30 years and I got my own room
That's
now.
That's funny.
Yeah,
That's very funny.
Made it, baby. Our connection was Andrew Holman.
Yes.
Andrew Holman and I would skip school and go to his house where Moby lived and just, you know, hang out because his house was relatively close to Pickering High School.
Yeah. When we say Moby, we're talking about Mark Holman.
That's right.
Not that other fool.
He still goes by the name of Moby. That is staying power. And actually, you gave Moby his name in his basement. That was...
Yes, when we were on our way to the studio with Stefan.
That's right, because he's a big fat whale. And so what had happened was I joined Kingpin with the intention of just sort of being an outside kind of guy. And I just wanted to play music. I just wanted to, and then I ended up sort of completely immersing myself into that band, not just financially, but just it became part of me. And I've said it before. I mean, I was forever changed after joining that band, and I wouldn't necessarily do half the things, wouldn't have done half the things I've done had it not been for meeting you and joining that band. And that was a life-altering situation. And I'm saying
I remember
now,
making the call to Dave Fortune and getting you that SNFU sound job.
That's right. Yeah, it was like, it was so... And in the day, I thought, you know, maybe we were being a little harsh to each other.
Oh, big time.
You know.
But so, I don't mean to cut you off, it just seemed like at that time, it was everybody was so well. I know I, for a fact, was so hell bent on survival because you know being relevant, even just as a youth, when you're in your 20s, you're such a fucking idiot. You know, like I don't mean to say that like I'm completely sorry for everything that I've ever done or said to people. I probably am 80% very, very sorry for what stuff I've done.
Sure,
but you know, at that time there was a. There was no punk rock. There was no focus for what we wanted anyways in Toronto or in Ontario. And so being what I considered myself a punk rocker and then having Mark Holman, who was a Yes fanatic, you know, and but had this great record collection and liked punk rock. But he had long hair and a mustache, like a beer store mustache is what we called, so you could get it served at the beer store. And then he knew all these punk dudes, or this guy Lee Ryan, that went to your school as well.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
I just couldn't believe that was that kind of stuff was going to be, it just seemed like all these other documentaries we've watched and stuff, it just seemed that at that time, if it didn't happen, it wasn't going to happen anywhere else. It just wasn't going to happen. So it had to happen with, like, I remember one time being number 5 out of the 7 punk rockers in Pickering.
Yeah.
All right. And this is before the guys even that were ahead of us. And Pickering, you know, has a heavy, an English, Irish, Scottish dominance,
German
and Dutch,
too.
German, and Jamaicans there as well. So there was always an advanced kind of art, I think, influence, whether it was music, because there was nothing but fucking kids everywhere. And kids got along with everybody. It was the parents that, truthfully, the parents had their prejudices and or their fears and anxieties, whereas like my best friend in elementary school was the same with Simon Kelly, and I would tell my mom and dad that, and then I brought him home, and my dad said, Jesus, he's black as the Ace of Spades, because Kelly, you know, the Irish names are all over Jamaica, so it's a weird kind of part of town, but I never thought that you'd end up being like a skateboarder in Pickering, but neither did we know at the time, this is how much we abused our hometown. Pickering, we didn't know this at the time, was the second, or if not the first, biggest skateboard distributor.
Yeah.
Because S&J was there. The first Vans distributor was in Pickering.
Yeah.
The first, like, Bones, Pal Peralta, that kind of stuff was in the Greenwich's house. And we lived in a beach town that we didn't give a fuck about because the end of Liverpool Road where the beach was for us looked like something out of Scooby-Doo. Like, it was an abandoned fucking...
Or you go and make out.
You get killed. Yeah. You'd go down there, you'd fall in the water, you'd drown, no one knew where you were. Or you'd go down and make out with someone.
Yeah, you'd
slip
make out
on the deck. Yeah, of the thing, and it was
you
just
see
that,
it now. It's completely.
It's like California. It's,
yeah,
it's like Venice Beach.
Yeah,
the only thing that's not down there's people that say we can reattach your foreskin. like I didn't understand this. Like you never really appreciate something until you leave. But I fucking hated it out there because there was no culture when we were out there. But then I don't even know where we are right now, Paul. I hope you're editing
this. I'm good. No, it's good. We're talking about what Pickering was.
And so there was, like, we had interesting cats like James Cavalluzzo, who took the new wave of British heavy metal to the furthest extreme with his band Mel Havoc, with his buddies John Cars and Nigel Williams.
Yeah.
The first black guy I knew to be into heavy metal. And then Jamaican. And then there was our corner. Myself, my best friend from high school, his name was Terry Wachter. We loved new wave of British heavy metal. That we eventually got into Metallica and Venom and those next waves, and then got into punk when we met Mark Holman with Lee Ryan and Stuart Chalk and Dave Koth. And we met another dude named John Paul McDonald. And him and I had the same birthday, so we thought we were going to be best friends. So everybody tried to start a band. And I didn't get to be in a band because everybody else was in one, but I always wanted to be the singer in a band. So I would see these guys, these Charlie Brown's Wang guys and Mel Havoc, and I would be like, come on, let me be your singer, let me do this, let me do that, or whatever. And they'd be like, no, I don't know why I wasn't taken seriously. I guess maybe I just didn't. I was also at the time planning on being an actor for some strange reason.
You were into drama, right?
I'm always into drama, Simon.
Yeah.
but
you were a drama kid.
I was, yes. Yeah. And I was working on getting a scholarship trying to get audition for a scholarship for the University of Windsor to go there for their theater program. And I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be a comedic actor or something like that. I don't know why. I just did. I excelled at it in school. It's what kept me in high school because I was a fucking asshole otherwise.
Well, you're quick-witted. I mean, it's a good natural selection for you to do that.
But then, as per usual, I was told I was too dangerous for that. So then I figured, okay, well, music is... I've always seemed to get myself in trouble by mouthing off about something or doing something that someone considers outrageous or silly.
Right.
I don't know what it is. I just, you know, when we go back to watching those other punk documentaries, like, you talk about dudes just being frustrated. I wasn't into, like, drugs or alcohol or anything like that at the time, so I just had this thing naturally. I just didn't understand where the fuck it was coming from. You'd sit there and stare at a wall for an hour. Why do I want to put my fist through this wall? Why do I want to smash my face into this wall?
Yeah.
It's got fuck all to do with music.
Yeah.
It's just the way you are.
Yeah.
So anyway, then our tribe merged with James's Mel Havoc, and then across the 401, there was these El Salvadorian immigrants, the Castellano brothers, Boris, Jaime, and Alvaro, and they started a band called Suburban Underground at first.
And they turned to Project.
And then this town with this big nuclear power station, you know, what we considered ourselves Russia's target forever, has this thriving music scene and culture. And then all of a sudden, when all this music and everything got together, those dudes, it was a Baha'i faith driven club that the Suburban Undergrounds used to run on Sunday afternoons called the Coffee House. And it went from 12 to 15 people to eventually being about 200 to 300 people. Yeah. We'd have to rent halls.
In the gymnasium.
Exactly. And
that's where my nursery school was, by the way.
Oh, wow. Well, on Valley Farm.
Yeah.
And, Like I said, we used to think we were Russia's target, and then all of a sudden we had this huge music scene, and then all of a sudden we had gay people, and all of a sudden we had, like, art people, and then we had this and we had that, and it was like I don't know, I don't want to say hate Ashbury or Greenwich Village, but out of nowhere, this, you know, you used to run from cops, you used to run from this prick named Mackie, Officer Mackie, who would hit you with your own skateboard, leave you in the middle of nowhere for you to walk home.
Yeah.
There wasn't much paved in Pickering at that time.
He was notorious for that. He was
a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
And then also
a fitting name.
You would get beaten up by whatever stoners or rockers, as you'd call them, that recall your punk rock music or your rock and roll, refer to it as kill your mother, kill your father music.
Yeah.
Which I only just found out is an actual name of a song by Discharge. I didn't know that.
I always thought it was actually imitating that Fear song, "Kill Your Mother and Father."
Didn't even
know
that. Anyway, so then it just seemed that Missing Link made a cassette. Well, Charlie Brown's Wang changed their names to Missing Link, and they made a cassette called Murder Music. And then all of a sudden, Mel Havoc made a cassette called Age of the Dark Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
Then Suburban Underground had a tape called Omed, which was demo backwards.
Mm.
I thought it was funny. And then I said, fuck this, I'm getting in a fucking band, I'm tired of this. So I don't know how I did it, I don't know where I got it. I think it was just watching everyone else be in their band. And I don't mean to say make mistakes, but see what they were doing, and I said, okay, I would do this differently. I would do that differently. I would do that differently. And I always wanted to be the singer in a band. I don't know why. Just always wanted to. And I met these dudes in Ajax named Jason Vincent, Mark Lepper, and Todd Laverty. And they had some guy, I can't remember his name right now. It was Mike Simpson. They had him singing for them, and they were trying to get their act together. And I said, well, I'm friends with Missing Link. You should meet these guys. Yeah. You should meet these dudes. And yeah. I said, I always wanted to be a singer in a band. And they said, well, why don't you come and try out? So I said, fuck it, okay. So I go there. And I was horrible. It was awful. But because no one else is going to say it, I knew, like you said, I knew what to do. I knew what to say.
Yep.
I knew what to not promise or not, but somehow team-wise say, this is what we can do. It's like I had hope because I wanted it so fucking badly. And maybe it's because I would see people that had musical training just basically waste it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what I thought it was.
There's drive. You're enthusiastic.
And I just was like, I knew there was something, we could do something better. Like, and I didn't even have any political ideas at that time. I couldn't even spell vegetarian, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So it was just a natural kind of thing. And I wish they wouldn't do that because I think my TV's fucked up.
Yeah, it's just weird. We're watching a hockey game right now.
Yeah, and,
it does look weird.
So anyways, I got into this band with these dudes, and then all of a sudden, within being in a band, I had a girlfriend.
Yeah.
It was really weird, and there was a little bit of popularity. And then all of a sudden, I didn't want to go to practices, but I sucked. I was horrible. I was absolutely horrible.
Who's that?
And they eventually called themselves 5 Foot Nothing.
Ah, that's right.
That was the name I came up with
for it.
And I was kicked out of that band for not caring enough or paying attention to it, and it absolutely destroyed me.
They were the serious guys in the scene, weren't they?
Well, they wrote pop music, and everybody loved them, and they were cute, but they were their own worst enemies as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
They didn't have any drive. They expected everybody else to do everything, and everybody did.
Don't hump my leg.
So, Marley, get down. And all of a sudden, like, Missing Link started doing things for them. And I hate to say it, I got really fucking jealous. I was fucking slighted. I was slighted. I was fucking pissed as fuck.
Yeah.
I wanted those guys fucking dead. But,
what's your tech say, Al?
They want us to play longer tonight.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Tell them no.
That's what I said.
Bose
and Pooza are paying us, so.
Hey.
Because I said my dream is to just go up, play 6 songs, and just walk off.
Yeah,
Oh, you've known that. I've always wanted that. I love that kind of fucking
power
of a band, right?
Up and down, yeah.
Who the fuck is going to argue with them?
No, showcase show.
Buy a record, take it home, listen to it all fucking day. Anyways, we're getting sidetracked.
Anyways,
so I wanted those guys dead, basically.
Yeah.
But now this is where it gets kind of weird. Once again, I started palling around Missing Link again, being their buddies, trying to help. My best friend, another best friend of mine, his name is Chris Langstaff, and I got him the job playing drums for Missing Link.
That's right.
I don't know, for some strange reason, I was this fucking...
You're the put people together guy.
It's weird, yeah. I was this corner, either a corner or a fucking a shelf or a fucking launching pad.
Or
an umbrella or a shoe or a fucking asshole, whatever. And got Chris and Missing Link, and then... So I palled around with those guys naturally, and then Missing Link played an all ages show at the Sibony, which was in Kensington Market, and they played with this band called Degenerate Youth. And there was these 5 guys from Etobicoke, sweethearts people, not too complicated individuals, just knew what they liked, and they were probably ridiculed for it. I probably made fun of them for sure because they're like 5 Scott Ians. From Anthrax, all long hair. They were younger cats, so they had all the right skate gear, Airwalks bands, Vision stuff, like everything. They were perfect. They looked like a junior SNFU.
Yeah.
The backwards baseball hat. They all had the Jason Newsted, the shaved side of the head. For lack of a better word, they were metal hardcore, hardcore metal guys.
Styled.
No, I wouldn't say styled. It was just whatever. It was, you know, backwards baseball hats and black t-shirts replaced the lumber jacket.
That's true.
And like Kodiaks were replaced by Vans or Airwalks, or Nikes now. So, but anyways, but Degenerate Youth had their shit together. They were a very, very good band, except for the Rototoms. But they were a really, really good band. The songs were there, and they were very good players. Tim Kowalski played bass, who Tim, you replaced him in Kingpin.
Yes, in Kingpin, yeah.
And Tim Gerard, as he's known publicly.
Oh.
And Tampa Bay score.
Yeah.
And then Mark Klucznik, God love him, a.k.a. Mark Gibson, was the lead guitar player and main songwriter for that thing. And I met him, along with Craig Schubert, Steve Baldwin. And they had this gaggle of women with them always, which was really fun.
They but, wrote, like groupies and stuff?
I don't say groupies, just high school friends. And all stuff. Right, okay, but anyway, cool. So I was talking to Mark, and Mark goes to me, "You're the singer for Five for Nothing." I'm like, I go, "I used to be. I got kicked out." And he goes, "Why?" I said, whatever, who knows. And he goes, I go, "What's up?" And I said, "You guys are really good." I go, "It's a bit metal, but it's really good." And then he goes to me, we're going to kick our singer out. And I go, "You are?" Yeah, I said, "Well," I go, "I'd like to try it." And he goes, "Fuck it, you should just do it." And I said, "Okay, sure." So he goes, "Yeah, so why don't you come on down to my house, this, this, and this, and we'll tell him he's out." This guy's name was Heath. Nice enough guy. He didn't like me at the time for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But
you gotta take his gig.
So I'd been talking to Mark on the phone just about influences. We all like the Descendants. We all like Black Flag. He liked a lot of Revelation Record stuff, like a lot of the straight edge hardcore New York stuff and California stuff, like Uniform Choice and all the Wishing Well Records kind of stuff. And I had just been broken up with by that girl that I got kicked out of Five for Nothing for. And I said, "Fuck it, I'm going to be in this band. Fuck theater, fuck my acting. I'm going to go be in this fucking band." I had a job at HMV in Pickering, and I would hop on the GO train and go down to Mimico all the time to practice. But anyways, my first time going down to the practice with them. I get there, and so I get into the room, and I see a bunch of this stuff here. And I go, "Whose stuff is this?" And they go, "Oh, it's Heath's." And I go, "You haven't told him yet, have you?" And they're like, all looking at the floor, right? And they're like, "Well, we just want to see what it sounded like before we made a decision." Oh, you fucking assholes.
That's not cool.
Oh, I'm like, "I like your style, but fuck, man, yeah. This is crazy."
Yeah,
so
it's pretty harsh.
We blast through a couple of Dag Nasty covers, and I try to squeal and screech my way through a Descendants cover, and they, I learned one of their songs, Generate Youth song, and then Mark meted, put his guitar, turned down his volume knob, and they had these phasers on their guitar. Yeah. I was like, "What is this?" Two kick drums, rototoms, and I'm like, "Come on, you're not the fucking crumb suckers. Let's go. Come on, this is ridiculous." And, anyways, Mark's like, "Let's do it. Al, you're in the band." So, fuck, this is great. And Mark had the gift. He could really put together a vocal melody on top of a guitar thing. He really knew how to write music.
Oh, yeah.
Communication
definitely.
Was horrible.
Yeah. It's true.
Otherwise,
very true.
God love him. But yeah. Anyways, so all of a sudden, the five of us all hopped on our skateboards and skateboarded over to this area of Mimico. I think we actually made a little difference and went a little further to Alderwood or Long Branch. I think it's Long Branch is where we went. Yes, Long Branch, I think. Long Branch is after Mimico.
Okay.
To the house where Heath lives. So I said, "Where are we going?" I said, "We're going to go kick Heath out." So I click, board up. I'm not fucking going over there. No way. So I go and stand around the corner from the place, a couple of houses down. And Mimico, there were like houses, I guess, that were built in the 40s and the 50s or 60s or something. It was a nice New Toronto suburb, it was called. It was called New Toronto. And it was, I guess, you either, there was these gigantic mansions, and then there was these fucking
post-war
army houses. Yeah. Right? And then the stench of the lake coming over, and then there was Newfoundlanders, Polish people, Ukrainians, Russians, and then Jamaicans, and then Torontonians, and they all hated each other.
Yeah.
They all hated each
other. They're all lake people, too.
I was like, "What the fuck? This is crazy." And it was what I really liked about, well, let's get back to the story thing.
Yeah.
So I see them go over to the house, and they go up the step, open the door, walk in. See the cigarettes light up, they're talking. Everybody smoked back then, everybody smoked inside, and I didn't, but anyways. And they're talking, and all I hear is fucking fuck. I'm like, "Oh shit." So here's the door come out, I go, "Yeah, whatever." But they had their own language. It's even weird. It's like the Shore is a crazy place, and I really love all those guys. They're called the Osno 13s, and I can't remember all of their names right now, but they really looked after each other, and they all knew each other. That's what really attracted me to that scene down there with those guys, because they'd all known each other from birth.
Yeah.
And everybody in Pickering, you're either born there or you moved there. So it was somewhat transient.
Yeah.
And you moved there or you didn't stay there and you went in and out.
So something older about the West End.
It's it was really older community. And being like an immigrant coming from Ireland, and my mom and dad's main reason for moving to a place with more space was they didn't want other people living in there or people knowing all their shit all the time.
That was a very, universal English and Irish thing.
But I couldn't get enough of that. All of a sudden, I'd be standing with them, and we'd be hanging out in front of this 7-Eleven on a store. And I'd only ever seen kids kind of do this, like, on television. Or we had a Becker's that we would hang out in front of. Remember down at the end of the Liverpool and Highway 2, the Becker's that we would hang out
I think I know. Yeah. Anyways, I don't know if I was part of the Becker's crew, though.
But whatever. But these guys would hang out, and one of their nightly amusements on Lakeshore was this, beside the 7-Eleven was this old hotel from the 40s, 30s called the Sagamore Hotel.
Okay, yeah.
And these dudes would sit outside this place and watch. This was when the last call was 12:30. I sound 100 by saying things. This is what last call. This is like, you'd watch all the Newfoundland drunks roll out on the street fighting with the Poles and the Russians, and they just beat the shit. And we'd be sitting there with, we'd call them diarrhea dogs, with 7-Eleven chili dogs. And you would just load up double, and you'd be there with your Slurpee. And,
cheese.
No one even smoked pot or hash. Yeah, yeah. I didn't anyways. I was just sitting around just
watching your skateboards go down.
Go back and practice. It was fucking wicked. It was like all those Black Flag books that I read. You know, all of a sudden I was doing this. It's like I'm in the Californian part of Toronto, the Lakeshore.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so gritty. It was really streety. And it wasn't like a brand new subdivision where we lived. Yeah. Well, not you, but where we lived and stuff. They were all packaged into these townhouses.
Yeah, it feels far away, too, because you have to take a train.
Well, I finally felt like I was a musician.
Yeah.
Because I'd known everybody. Everybody knew your weaknesses. Nobody. See, the problem with knowing each other so long is, and this would end up later on happening in Trigger Happy, everybody knew each other's weaknesses so much that we forgot and forgot about each other's strengths. Forgot to really, and that's what, unfortunately, you do that because you become so close to someone. I'm very close to you, and I know in a fact I could say to you, you're a fucking asshole, but I love you at the same time, and you would still get it.
Yeah.
But sometimes when you get into that kind of role, even with bands and stuff, it's
you start getting the luggage and appreciating the luggage.
You know what the worst thing anybody's ever said in a band? I'm getting off topic, but it's the thing. You know, and I've said it, and I've heard people say it, and I think it's really sad because it's true, because 30 years later it proves that no one is replaceable.
Yeah.
Because something is always going to be different. Now, whether it gets better, that's fine.
Yeah.
But, like, there's a drummer in town that I absolutely love hanging out with, but I don't want him in my band. And I won't say who he is.
Yeah, I know.
But I absolutely fucking love the dude. But I just don't. He's too unreliable, and his timing's all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's because of what I like doing with him. I don't want to play with him, but I love him to death. And then, but it's like so many times in Trigger Happy, it was just, there was meanness just for the sake of meanness. And even in Kingpin in the early days, like we were really, really hard on each other. And I think it was almost like we wanted to prove to each other, I can do this. I could do this.
Yeah, it's a brotherly thing too. Like,
it's, I guess, for lack of a better word, family kind of thing. But
do you think that that's something, though, that you didn't really get as a kid, though?
So I didn't have any brothers and sisters, so I had no idea. So that's.
But you, I mean, honestly, to understand having siblings, it's tricky. And I think but what happened was that became your brothers. Those are your brothers.
I craved this belonging of a family, so it was kind of gross and creepy. I would go and create these families with bands, and I still kind of do.
Yeah, and it's, well, I think that at least you're not going to just get introverted and just fucking sit in your room and smoke pot. There's things now that you can
sit in a room with four other guys and smoke
pot.
With the band, we'll get onto the subject that probably no one really knows about, and that's that fucking car, that van accident.
Yeah.
That was, I don't know if a long time ago, and then I think, what year was it?
I think it was 91.
91.
Yeah.
Simon, God love him, bought him spot our band a van.
Yeah.
And we tricked it out to go across the country, because the first tour we did was a minivan with all our gear and five guys, which was stupid, but we did it. And
we got to talk about that part of it.
The second tour we had, we thought we were the shit, I guess, and then crash our van, and this is where everything changed. I ended up with 14 stitches in my head.
I could see your skull.
That's right. And I thought I was blind because the blood was so thick in my eyes. I thought I was blind.
It's a good tea, by the way.
Good.
Yeah.
The that survival bullshit when we got home. I guess I was dealing with the stitches in my head, and you were dealing with not having a vehicle.
Yeah, and I knew there was an omen to that van, and I don't think...
Really?
Yeah, I knew there was...
I never thought that.
And it was a weird... I had dreams about it. I knew that
I
something...
I remember that.
I had a weird... You know, the omen was is that the side mirror got ripped off the first time we took it through the car wash.
Oh, my God.
You remember that?
I just remember the smell of the balsam wood and how fucking gross it smelled in there.
I was so depressed when the side mirror got ripped off. I was like, oh, this is bad. But you know what? I woke up and I said, hey, we're driving down the road. And I said, we got to stop this van, like, stop. And it wasn't stopping, and no one was listening to me, and I knew it was going to happen. Like, I knew it was going to happen.
Oh, I was asleep.
Yeah.
That was the first time I actually got used to sleeping.
How do you sleep now in a movie vehicle?
Well, the funny thing was, when after everybody went their way, the tribe split, and I got Wally and Brad and Mark in the band, and we lucked out and got to do that Bad Brains tour, Bryce... was driving a van for us, and I was asleep.
Yeah,
and he woke me up. Oh, we're in Golden, BC, and here we go. And I was like, "Holy shit, Marley, cut it out!
Don't hump my leg anymore."
My dog seems to be humping Simon's leg.
Yeah,
but he woke me up for that. But I don't think you have to go through there anymore because of some kind
of bypass.
Yeah, Coca-Cola thing. But I remember that first tour. Us waiting for fucking sheep to go across and stuff.
Elk.
Yeah, that's right.
We did this. Yeah, the first tour. It's so funny how the very first tour we did was your very first tour, my very first tour, and one of the first bands from Pickering to actually leave town.
And where was our first show?
Portland, Oregon.
From one end of the P to the other.
So we rented a minivan, rent a wreck. I speak about this in another podcast, and yes. We rented a minivan and loaded it up, and not only did we take the five of us, but we took Dummy. Mark Demirsky.
Well, there was only four of us in the
band. Was there four of us? Yeah. Oh, that's right. So we took five of us.
Because you had six strings, so that's right.
Did I have six strings on that tour?
I think that was that bass, Ibanez.
Fuck that. Yeah, and then we... Yeah, so we had, and what happened is my dad, it's so funny you say that because my dad was the one that disconnected the odometer and is the one that connected it. He was in
That's
on
when
it.
He liked us.
Yeah, yeah.
Or yeah. Like me, anyway.
It's true. Well,
it's true. Yeah.
So, you know, we drive across. Our first show is in Portland, Oregon. We drive across. We stop in Madison, Wisconsin. And
we stopped everywhere. Well, that was also the first kind of
first vacation
I ever had.
Yeah,
except for going to Ireland with my family.
We drove through the Badlands.
Devil's Tower. That was amazing.
Welcome,
Montana. Population 150 people in the 7-Eleven video rental site. It was all hunting films.
Yeah,
that was wild. That's the thing. That was people go backpacking across Europe. People do that kind of shit. I used to say like you. Your intention was to fucking go to Whistler and be a fucking Tojo out there.
Yeah. What brought me back is I broke my arm.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, where was I going with this? Like I said, I wanted to travel. I wanted to get out of there, but I wanted to do it the way I wanted to do it. And I only wanted to do it with the band. To this day, I don't like going anywhere unless the band's gone there first.
Yeah.
When I was a marathon boyfriend, my girlfriend's hated me because I never wanted to go anywhere. I come home from tour, so fuck it, I'm not going anywhere. I want to sit in my living room. I would fantasize about sitting in while I'm in a van or in some shithole freezing to death.
Yeah,
living off a burrito.
That was so exciting about that is because we're all... I'm going to put this a little closer to your face there. We were all kind of doing it together, you know?
Yes.
We were all...
Well, no, well, without being rude, there was one of us that said we were doing it, and the other three going, okay.
Yeah, I get it.
That's all. Because Moby was into it. You didn't know what the fuck was going on, but none of us knew what the fuck was going to happen. But for some strange reason, Mark and I knew what was going to happen because we had, as far as I was concerned, we had read the books.
Yes,
okay. We read all these Black Flag books.
Yeah.
That said, in the van, in the this, and doing that, doing this. And I'm like, fuck, I can't fucking wait.
Yeah.
Please. But meanwhile, we didn't know that all those Black Flag books, those guys were all fucking tripping out on acid in the back of those books.
So our first tour was Down by Law. And
the real Down by Law.
Of course.
Dave Nasworthy, Ed Ehrlich.
Ed Ehrlich.
And it was Chris from Clawhammer. It wasn't Jamie Pina who was in the Chemical people.
Yes. Clawhammer, yes.
Chris was in Clawhammer. And then the infamous legend, Dave Smalley.
Yes. Dave, who is
my favorite Republican.
he's on the show. Did you hear that one?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, he called in.
I said it. Yeah, my favorite Republican.
Yeah. So we meet all these people, and these are your rock stars. Like,
yes, these were my Alex Lifesons to your Geddy Lees and stuff and everything. Because I was a huge DYS fan. Well, Moby and I just worshipped DYS, and that was a Smalley straight edge band in the late 70s, 80s in Boston. And we just loved that fucking shit. And there we are now. Like, all it took was Stefan's record. Well, we were lucked out when we had Stefan come up and record an album.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was pretty dynamic at the time. That was a bold move for a little band from Pickering to say, fuck it, we're getting the guy that does all our favorite albums to come up and do this. And he came up for $1,200.
Yeah.
That he actually didn't get the whole thing until, like, maybe the 10, maybe 2 days after he went back to Missouri or something like that. It was fucking, because Yard couldn't get his money together or something. But see, that's scary kind of time too. But anyways, and I wasn't very friendly during that whole thing either, but whatever, it doesn't matter, because I was bankrolling most of the fucking thing. I borrowed $2,000 off of a guy I worked with to record the album.
No shit. Really?
I'm fucking name, Tommy DeVito from Jersey Boys. I used to go get deals with people, do this, hustle this with people. Like, I was I guess the mover or whatever. And but I could count on you for the science, Moby for the rock, you know, and then Yard to be cool, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. Right. That's true. I mean, we all kind of had our little jobs, you know? Yeah, so when we kicked out Moby, we kind of switched everything around a lot, like a lot.
That's where everything went black, because
I
can admit to you, I was never the same after that.
After the crash.
My head was split open, and like I was saying, trying to say earlier, but we went back and filled in the blanks.
Yeah.
The shows we had planned with Down by Law, Moby's band went and fucking took.
Yeah,
that hurt. That fucking pissed me off too.
Yeah, that hurt.
Because I also I was like, what the fuck are we gonna do now? Like,
yeah.
The fuck? And then, I remember being on the phone with you, and I'm like, what do you want me to do, Simon? And you're like, well, I'm like, exactly. What the fuck do you want me to do?
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm like, what the fuck do you want me to do? And I remember, I've never been that angry before, and my head was hurting. I think there was something wrong with my back too, and it was those $4.99 phones you could get at the flea market. Like, they were like one piece, you just slid it back on the wall, you'd screw the thing back on the wall and you'd slide in there, and I took the thing, smash, I smashed the phone. My mom and dad were like, what the hell is wrong with you? And I'm like,
oh no.
So I go upstairs, pull my phone out of the wall, bring it downstairs, plug it in for them. I'm like, there's your fucking phone. And
I'm
like,
I'm sorry.
Hold on, you're 21.
Yeah.
You're screaming at your mom and dad like this. The house that they let you come back to live in after you're gallivanting around the country.
Yeah.
Right? You're split open from fucking top to tail.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the fuck?
Emotionally broken.
Exactly. Yeah. Because disappointment is worse, right? And we worked our asses off to get around that
such
fucking
thing. Such a hard pill to swallow. Reality for the first time.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was also our mortality was in question.
Definitely.
But nobody cared.
No.
Nobody gave a fucking shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, as childish and juvenile as this sounds, there was a bigger deal made about fucking Brad Fisher from Red Fisher's fingertips being fucking plucked off. I heard about that fucking forever, and we almost all fucking died. Nobody gave a fucking crap. Yeah. Nobody fucking knew anything.
There would have been a fundraiser
or something. Whatever. I don't know, maybe
Kickstarter.
But I remember we at Epidemic Records, we made a promo thing saying Trigger Happy were killed in a van, but I put almost.
Yeah.
Smalls to try to generate some hype about it. Nobody wanted to interview us about it. Nobody wanted to fucking talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I've seen it somewhere here. I have the Polaroid, I think, of the van cracked.
You do?
Yeah, it's somewhere.
I haven't seen
it's
it.
Somewhere in here. I don't know.
Because we had a video camera, but there, the battery
Moby,
was flat.
No, but Moby has video footage that he's always said he's going to dig out, but he never will. Because I think it has Demiris peeking in on him in the shower in the townhouse up in Sudbury. But God rest Mark Demiris. Anyways,
Mark Demiris.
Yeah, and then I think during all that frustration, I think Ron said to me, are you going to keep the band? Yes, yes, of course I'm going to.
Yeah.
And I know you weren't very pleased with whatever was going on. And Jim Norton said, you have to keep the band going. That's another spectacular star in our story. Jim Norton said, no, you got to keep this band going. This is a band I want to be in. And we're like, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we were like, I didn't even come together as the singer I wanted to be yet, right? Like, or I wanted to be the villain. I wanted to be like a a Black Bart kind of character of like, you know, you could, you love him, but he's, watch it, he's got a fucking, he'll
you honed turn that on you shit, in a second. Though. Like, right? You honed it in, like, you good. You
But I didn't learn to do that stuff until...
Like wrestling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I didn't learn how to do that stuff until it was with Jim Norton.
Yeah.
And, but like I said, Jim said, well, we got to find a guitar player because I'm going to play bass. And you said, or no, he was going to play guitar. And then you said, well, I don't mind playing drums.
Yeah, that's right.
You switched to playing drums, but we had to find a guitar player. And then that's when someone told me, Mark just got kicked out of Monster Voodoo Machine.
Yeah.
So I was like, what?
And the funny thing is, the drum kit we used? Chris Langstaff's drum kit.
Good point.
I never owned a drum kit.
That's right. But I still remembered Mark's phone number from Deep End. Sorry, we have to fill this in now. Deep End got to, after we kicked that, Heath got kicked out, we changed the name to Deep End, became this pop group. Within a month, we wrote 8 songs and learned 1 Fear cover. Within a month of recording it, we had a 12-inch vinyl out.
That's insane.
And 1989. And yeah. I think by spring of the next year, 1990, Moby said, I'm starting a band and you're going to be the singer and you're leaving Deep End. And I said, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Because Moby Dolby has been the guitar player I wanted to play with.
Yeah.
And, but probably if I shouldn't have left Deep End, who knows what would happen. But it's funny that we would end up getting Mark
come back
from Deep End because I said, I know his phone number. I still know his phone number right from Lakeshore where he's lived with his mom and dad. So I remember, beep, boop, 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 boop. And I said, hey, what do you want?
I think I was in the room when you made that call.
I think, and he's like, what do you want? And I'm like, oh, I heard something's changed. And he's like, yeah. What happens? Oh, fuck those guys. Who cares? They're fucking idiots, man. I'm like, all right, well, I need a guitar player.
Oh, yeah?
Well, what kind of stuff are you doing? I can't play that Moby shit. And I'm like, no, I said, we want to be more straightforward. And I got the bass player from, what did I say? Jim used to be in a band called Crucial Youth.
Crucial Youth, yeah.
And he goes, what? Because Mark loved that straight edge kind of crap. Yeah. And they were a joke kind of band.
They were like a mock straight edge.
A Ruddles kind of thing, if you will. And I said, and Simon's going to play drums, so. I remember when he came and we changed some of the songs, like Tempest. And,
yeah, he made it his, and it all got really heavy.
Fucking really thick. It thickened up like crazy. And the guy had he had a fucking swagger or had a way.
Yeah.
You know, it drove me crazy, but I longed for it. I don't know why. Yeah. I fucking loved the guy.
I liked the way he used to tune guitars. He never had
a tuner. Volume.
He never had a tuner.
Yeah, well, see,
I don't think we had tuners.
No, Mark was like Mark was truthfully like the most badass insecure badass. Like he was insecure badass. Yeah. Like most badasses are, but like it was just funny. Like his job at that time, he said, "I just want to be in a band," and I'm like, "No problem, man. Let's do it." And we were at that time. There was like pop punk wasn't really a thing. It was still kind of like Helmet was the most grooviest band and Therapy. And,
Bad Religion.
Bad Religion were around, but it was still considered simple. That that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was still considered kind of simple, and because we also didn't get all those Epitaph full releases up yet, until we started watching those snowboard videos and skateboard videos, Pennywise and all that kind of stuff, and then.
I tell you, Against the Grain changed my life.
No, oh, that's great.
As much as Iron Maiden, Number of the Beast.
That was Kingpin's very first show. Was playing with Bad Religion at the Rivoli.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I wasn't. Yeah. Yeah.
You weren't in the band. Yeah. No. Well, you played with this when we played with them at the Spectrum.
Yes, that's right.
They fucked with the PA, so we couldn't be heard for half the set.
They unplugged the vocal. Did the important shit, you know? I actually talked to somebody who saw that show.
Yeah, I think somebody said to me. I think it was because. We were on the show, so therefore Bliss couldn't play, and Bliss drove from Montreal because Helmet wanted them to play. And then when we were there, they said, no, well, I'm sorry. And I wouldn't budge.
I remember.
Is that survival thing I'm talking about. I wouldn't budge.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm ashamed to say this. There was a time when we were on tour with All, Kingpin. We were doing All shows, and Mark had called me because Deep End was still going, and he was singing in Deep End, and he called me up and said, hey, the promoter said in London or this or that, that he'll let us have 20 minutes if you'll split your set with us. And I said, no.
Yeah.
I said, no, forget it.
Yeah.
So I worked too hard to give half this shit away. And he's like, you're a fucking asshole. Takes one to know one.
Dog, motherfucker.
And then to get him back in the band, and then I guess, like I introduced you to John Stewart and those dudes, and
that's right. Yes,
yeah. Once again,
Al once again puts people together. Yeah, yeah, puts people together, and
because even the original idea was I was going to snake all you fuckers. I was going to go to Winnipeg and sing for Redfish.
Oh, really?
That was my plan.
That's the cahoots. Everybody wanted to be in that band. That's hilarious.
But I don't think I would have lasted long in Winnipeg.
No, you would have lasted about as long as I did. Yeah, it was about a year and a half. Well, yes, because what happened, I tell the story that I answered your phone, and it was John Stewart.
That's right, yes.
And he said, we just kicked Brad out of the band.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm
or Brad player. Quit or yeah. something. And I'm like, need a bass player? Because I was playing drums, and it was like...
Oh, I know. It was, we all
it was frustrating.
Happened. Yes. It was, well, no, because those pricks came for Canadian Music Week.
That's right, and they stayed at my house.
Yeah, and you were driving around, and you fell in love with them, and all this and I remember Jason Tate. When we were going to play our show, there's more people getting in this van. I said, what do you mean?
It's our van. This van, asshole. Yeah, that was a replacement.
I've never forgiven him for that.
That was the gray one.
Yeah, I would see him in the weaker thans. And I'm going, the only thing that ever impressed me about Jason Tate was the fact that he saw Flag at the Royal Albert. So that's fine.
That's
so you're
true.
Okay with me, buddy.
Yeah, there you go. Anyways. Okay, you're okay with me, but don't fall asleep on the couch when I come to town next time.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
And so what had happened was that Jim joined the band, and he sort of turned into sort of the de facto
Jim,
manager.
The new sheriff in town, and you didn't like that expression. And I was like, finally, someone else taken. And Jim was just encouraging the fuck with the audience thing. And that, like, you played that show when we went and played. I was talking to Dave Danilov about it. Mm-hmm. We went to London. We did two shows. We played one.
That's right, and I broke two drum heads.
One at Blue Ox, and then we went down to, and that's when we started thinking like the Black Flag way from the books, like fucking, we're gonna play two shows, we're gonna kill them, we're gonna destroy them.
It was the embassy.
Yeah, the embassy the embassy and the Blue Ox. It was called.
The Blue Ox?
Because we had to play with that fucking piece of shit, Boris's back.
Okay.
We would call him Horace's hump. And,
yeah.
And whatever. Anyways, and that was the night that we were in the back stage area or whatever the room. No, I think Mark and I were smoking a joint or something. Jim was making fun of us, and then we were drinking beers. And someone came in from the club and said, Dave Danilov was in there with us. Someone came in from the club and went, hey, you can't do that. You can't fucking do that, blah, blah, this. And then Mark and I looked at each other and went, get the fuck out of here. Fuck off. Like, get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of our fucking room. And like, totally just... Well, let's try it. See what happens. Right. And so we started yelling at the guy. He's like, oh, fuck, something. Get out of there. And Danilov starts laughing his ass off. And Jim Norton's like, dude, that was wicked, but next time take your shirt off and do it. Or do it in your underwear. See what happens. And that's when Jim fucking, you remember that show? Jim fucking, we're about to go and play. Jim strips down to his fucking zebra skin fucking Speedo. And I'm like, what the fuck is this all about?
It was a force.
Right? And then I, all of a sudden, because the audience baiting and banter was to make up for the lack of songs, because we only had six or
that's
seven.
That's true. Yeah, we practiced like three times or something.
We made up, like, we wrote Lever.
Yeah.
And we kept Ulcer Man.
I love the reason it's called Lever.
It's 2,000 parts. 2,000 parts.
And I used to love practicing at Mark's place, because I used to go out by the water.
Yeah.
Oh, and my hands hurt so much, because I'm not really a drummer.
Yeah.
But I'd go out and sort of, and it was so quiet and nice, and it was such an amazing experience being in his house, you know, in that basement.
I hate to do this to you.
Yeah.
End of part one. But take
to be
time.
Continued, everybody.
Yeah, I guess gotta wash myself.
And that was episode 43, the edited safe version. So once again, I cut a part of this podcast out, and it will be forever gone. So because it's my show, I can do what I want. I can edit. I can come back and do it later. But what I do know is that this is one of the best episodes of the series of podcasts, and it was over 200 years. It was 200 episodes ago. Holy crap. So anyways, I think it's befitting that this episode comes out because it's 200 episodes ago. Thank you so much for listening to the show. This one's coming out as an extra little bit, but I want you to enjoy this in the episode that came up just a couple of days ago with the bracket episode. And I really hope you have a good week, and we'll see you Monday. If not, I'll see you again. Okay? Have a good week. Bye.